Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. As I mentioned last week, there's a new book out on 9/11 called Methodical Illusion by Rebecca Roth, a former flight attendant. It's written as fiction, but the facts come through loud and clear. The book is getting lots of attention, and here with me today is Rebecca Roth to discuss her new book, Methodical Illusion. Rebecca Roth, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes, now you just wrote the fascinating book, Methodical Illusion, which I read thoroughly and I couldn't put it down. Great book. First of all, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background as a flight attendant and how that got you to question the official account of 9/11 and then ultimately to write this book.
Oh, sure. I flew for about 30 years at the time of 9/11 as both an international purser and a flight attendant. And like many, many other people, it was too painful for me to really look into the details of 9/11, especially while I was still actively flying. The things that happened that day were nearly impossible. I sat and luckily was at home and watched it on television, and it just raised all kinds of red flags for me. Being as though NORAD, the FAA, and all of those military establishments are put into place as our safety net, I literally was unable to look at those red flags until after I retired. And then I was the person on the crew that everyone always told me, oh, you should write a book because excitement always seems to follow me. It really has with this book. But So I started to write a novel after I retired just about the mysterious life as a flight attendant, and because it's something that's really mystery to people when you're, you know, saying, oh, I'm going to be in Tokyo tomorrow, and then I'll be in Hong Kong, and they're going, oh, wow, you know, well, it sounds really great when you're listening to it from the outside, but it's kind of a mysterious job and a whole lifestyle. So I started to write this novel, and I wanted a character's name for a Middle Eastern character that I was going to introduce in my book. And you will see this in the first few chapters of my book, which are on my website. I started to write the book, and I thought, I want to bring in a Middle Eastern character. Now, I had not really looked into 9/11, even though I knew on day one there was something wrong with the story. I Google searched 9/11 hijackers, and I'll just grab a first name from one and a last name from another one. And lo and behold, a BBC article shows up dated September 2001, I think it was 21st or 23rd, like within a week or two after 9/11, that was exposing that six of the hijackers were still alive. Four of them were actual professional airline pilots working for Saudi Arabia Airlines, and that's a government-owned airline. And I was like, what? I could not believe what I was reading. This had never hit my head. I'd never heard this. I'd never read it. I studied a lot of, and I watched the first 3 days on television unfold, and I just never heard of such a thing as this. And so what happened was, when I saw that the Saudi government was threatening to sue the FBI, they actually were using their pilots' home addresses, their names, and their photos from their passports. Now, can you imagine being an airline? See, for me, I looked at it this way. You're being an airline professional, you're flying around the world, and you're tagged as a 9/11 terrorist? I was like, oh my goodness, this must have destroyed their lives. So the Saudi Arabian government threatened to sue the FBI, and I could not find any outcome of that. There had to have been a payout because there was never a lawsuit, and they never changed the story. And those four guys are still flying for Saudi Airlines.
Wild,
so what happened to me when I did that? Yeah, it was like a hammer over my head. So what happened to me, I just put my book on hold, my original book, and I just went into studying. First off, I just couldn't believe that somebody lived through what I thought I saw, and then I started to think maybe what I thought I saw I didn't see at all. And then I found that 10 of the hijackers are still alive, and there are people that are professionals that are much more have looked into this on a professional basis that claim that the other nine are quite possibly, just like I was going to do, made up people, where they grabbed a first name from someone and a last name from someone else and just created these people. Since I let my book out, it was released the middle of November, I've had people come forward from the two airlines that were involved that claim they have a copy of the official real passenger manifest, in which none of those 19 names are on, any of those. So as I started researching, I just put that book on hold, and I went in about 20 hours a day for two or three years just compiling information and building charts and learning about all the things that went on that day that I didn't know about. This Brady Bonds, stolen gold, insurance fraud, the put options, money laundering, stolen computer software, and just started compiling all the people who were attached to all of the stuff that went on. That I think that most of us in the media that watched it unfold, all we got out of it was 19 Middle Eastern hijackers did this to us, and that's our enemy. But there's a lot more to that than the whole event than what we were shown and told on television. So once I gathered all that information, and then I was just like, wow, how am I going to put this out? And I just decided I'd go ahead and keep writing that original novel. And so you can kind of see the first three chapters are kind of character building.
Mm-hmm.
They're not about 9/11. They're just sort of about being a flight attendant and what an airline really does in an emergency like a crash or an event like this hijacking terrorist attack. One of the things that struck me odd that morning was that the personal information from the passengers and crew was disseminated via CNN and other networks, and that is something that just would not typically normally happen. The airlines professionally just have a standard that they follow, and I'm sure if you were a passenger or your spouse were, you would appreciate this. This is the standard procedure. They contact the family, the next of kin of every crew member and every passenger before that information becomes public. Because you don't want to read about your spouse being involved in something. I mean, you might know he's on flight such and such, and if there's no survivors, then you're seeing this on the news, but you're not going to hear the stuff that was released as early as it was on 9/11. So I put all those things in there. There's some airplane accidents and things to show the reader what an airline really does do in the event of some kind of accident or event like that.
Right, so there was a lot of airline protocol that wasn't followed on 9/11 at all.
A whole lot of it, yeah. And so what I did was, as I was doing my research, now, unlike a lot of people, I can do textbooks and I can do deep research. And what I ended up doing was I was finding so much conflicting information. For instance, you hear a flight attendant just minutes before impact on Flight 93 calling and leaving a message on her home phone and then calling and talking to her husband. And it's very quiet in the plane. And she's like, honey, I'm sorry. I love you. I miss you. We've been hijacked. And tell the kids I love them. I'll see you in heaven. And I've listened to, and I watched and I read all the details. And then I put it next to the National Transportation Safety Board and FAA documentations where they're claiming that at that same moment she's talking like that and sounds like she's just in a little room all by herself talking, you know, nothing's going on. The airplane's coming down 6,000 to 10,000 feet a minute. Well, that's beyond an emergency descent. And so if you ever have a decompression where the airplane has to get down as fast as possible to, you know, below 10,000 feet, and you do an emergency descent like that, that's really pushing the envelope of the safety of the aircraft. But it's scary, and everybody on the plane would have been screaming, and the plane would have been making a very loud shudder ruddering sound. You'll feel like the wings are going to fall off. It's very frightening. Mm-hmm. And you would not, especially her, would not be sitting there calling your husband at a time like that. You would be taking care of your passengers and making sure that there wasn't going to be further damage or you'd be strapped in. And the G-forces involved with a descent like that, you would not be just sitting talking on a phone. You probably wouldn't even be holding a phone. Sure as heck wouldn't have any phone reception on any kind of phone when you were
talk to us a little bit about that. You said cell phones didn't work even in normal cruising altitude.
Yeah, you know, the airplane, actually, I remember around that time, the 2000, 2001 era, being in a 757 in the back galley area with a bunch of flight attendants, and we all had different cell phones. You know, we had Nokias and Ericssons and those little phones that, you know, had the little window and the little, you know, remember the old phones from the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And so we would look and go, do you have any bars? Oh, I don't have any reception. Well, I don't either. And we were at a major hub airport sitting at a gate. Just the aluminum and the wiring inside the aircraft acts like a Faraday cage. And so there isn't good cell reception, even though it might have worked in the terminal, because you see a lot of people in the terminal. And some people think that airports have cell phone jammers. That's not true, because if you go look in a terminal, almost everybody's talking on a phone. And they were then, too. But you walk in the aluminum aircraft with all the information, all the wiring, all the stuff that's in there. And it's actually kind of like being in a cabin or a house that has a metal roof. It blocks your cell phone reception. Uh-huh. So you have to go out to the porch to talk. Anybody that's traveled around and stayed in a cabin in the mountains or something has a metal roof for the snow load and stuff. You'll see that's the problem. It's that. And the airplanes actually did that around that time. Now, there are different systems in place now. There are actually airplanes that connect to a satellite, but we're talking 2001. So you have to kind of look back to that. And they didn't work. And they sure as heck didn't work at altitude. And a Flight 93, they were almost all reported to be cell phone calls. Flight 93 is the one that supposedly went into Shanksville in Pennsylvania. And those calls didn't start until the airplane was out 45 minutes in flight. So it was well over 35,000 feet. And nobody seemed to have a problem. One of the interesting things about that flight was that one of the guys called, he called a minute before the FAA claims the flight was taken over by hijackers. 1 minute before, somehow a passenger knew the plane was hijacked. Passengers don't know anything unless a flight attendant tells them. They don't. I mean, okay. You usually have to tell them two or three times on a PA announcement before they actually wake up and listen or pull their headphones off or wake right. up and get the message. So I'm like, okay, how did a passenger know 1 minute before the pilots knew that they were hijacked? I mean, that's impossible. But that particular guy called his wife, and she was a retired flight attendant. And so when his cell phone shows up on her caller ID, and she was in California, she thought, well, obviously he didn't get on the plane. He's calling from his cell phone. So she's like, all right, well, is everything okay, and what's going on? Then he has to tell her, I'm in the air, we're on this plane, blah, blah, blah. Her mind is saying exactly what mine would. No, you're not, because you're calling from your cell phone. That's impossible.
You've had this discussion with this woman?
Well, it's well written up on the whole 9/11 event.
Okay.
I mean, it's in FBI documentation, so I've read everything about this, and a lot of what I got for my book, especially in the 9/11 stuff, is from FBI documentation. So when the FBI showed up at her house, they tried to claim that, no, he didn't call you from his cell. And she said, yes, he did. I'll show you my caller ID.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, I thought, why would the FBI argue with her that? Well, here's why. In short, the perpetrators probably should have used a flight attendant for consulting to plan this event. One, cell phones don't work at altitude. Sure as heck didn't in 2001. And two, they didn't follow the FAA set in stone hijacking protocols. We had code words and we had specific procedures that we were to follow. And that was another thing that I kept going back to, is why didn't the flight attendants follow protocol for a hijacking? That's
kind of how
I kind of dug into this. And I just kind of kept going back to my own training, you know, just dissecting this. So I ended up putting all these charts together with the phone calls, the words they said, what the aircraft was doing if it was descending 6 to 10,000 feet a minute, and then posting all of these calls that were coming out. And there were, Flight 93 was all emotional calls. It was, you know, I'll see you in heaven kind of thing, tell the kids I love them, and just all things to get us emotionally involved. And then I realized that if this really were a terrorist, for one, the flight leaving Washington, D.C. was not, you know, 10 miles from the Pentagon, but yet it flew for an hour and more than an hour and a half out all around the country. And anybody that knows our system knows that we have jets that scramble in 6 minutes and would shoot them down or guide them into an airport.
Right.
So nobody in their right mind would have done that as a hijacking.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made no sense at all from any angle I looked at it.
So do most people within the airline industry know that we've been lied to about this? Do they get this? Or?
Yeah, they do. And what happened is, and this was a kind of a hurdle for me too as an airline person, I trusted the FAA flight pass. I thought that they were right. I went to Cleveland. I found that Delta flight 1989. It was a bomb threat, and all these people thought that all the passengers were put on one plane and taken there. But really, that was a separate deal, and Delta did have a bomb threat. I actually have now all of the recordings from the air traffic control, a terabyte of Freedom of Information Act information from 9/11, from the FAA, NORAD, everything. You can't imagine all the information I've gotten since I released the book. From, you know, other researchers have just brought me into this and are kind of looking at all of it. But I have heard from so many airline people thanking me for writing the book and saying, I always knew, but we always trusted the FAA. And what I found out was there was two companies inside the FAA headquarters leading up for 2 years before 9/11. On that day, there were military exercises going on, and their job was to make fake bogeys or targets show up on radar screens for the military pilots that were part of these war games. And so they could make things appear on screens for FAA and NORAD. That's the military and the FAA, two separate types of computer radar data screens. They could make things appear and disappear.
And do you know what those companies' names were?
I do. One is called MITRE, M-I-T-R-E, and one of them is called PTEC. So I found that they were doing that, and then I remembered in maybe the early to mid-90s that a device was sold to the airlines, not all of them bought, but it's a plug-in device, much like, and I'm just going to say like something you plug into your computer, like a USB, I mean simple plug-in device. It's not something you need mechanical overhauling of a computer or anything. Some airlines bought these. They were called the flight termination system. It's the same system we use to navigate our remote control aircraft, our drones in the Middle East or around the world that we're killing people with from, you know, air bases in Nevada or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the flight termination system. The flight termination system was sold, and listen carefully, in the event that a terrorist got control of the airplane inside the cockpit, the plane could be taken over remotely and landed where it could be liberated by a Delta Force or Army SEALs or Navy SEALs or Army Rangers or some special ops group. So you have to ask yourself, well, then why didn't they use that day? Because we had hijackers in the cockpit that had taken over the plane. Well, because it was already in use. How I know that was in use is the reason our pilots, our professional pilots across the country that knew that this was being sold by Boeing to the airlines in the event of a hijacker getting in the cockpit, is that once the flight termination system took over, they lost their transponder and all ability to communicate with anyone, including the flight attendants. So they couldn't talk to the airline, they couldn't talk to air traffic control, they couldn't talk to the flight attendants in the cabin.
And in the book, you say that the planes, that the actual four flights did not hit the Twin Towers or the Pentagon, but that they were some other kind of plane?
That's correct. And that's as good a guess as anyone's. What we do know by, and this is what I saw the day that I watched it all happen, is there was no airplane crash. There's no airplane parts at the Pentagon in the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, these huge jets that hang and they're 40 feet apart. If it would have been at the ground surface like that, it would have, one, not been going the speed they claimed, and two, the engines would have made big divots in the grass. They also would have made separate holes in the building. So the whole theory of this plane going into this Kevlar and steel reinforced wing of the Pentagon is crazy, but there's nothing left. And you see a plane crash, just Google search an image search 757 crash. You can see what's going to be left. You're going to have landing gear. You're going to have gigantic tail section. That tail section's like 120 feet high or some crazy thing. It's big. And it's not going to go into the building and disappear. So what we saw is no wreckage. And we even had Jamie McIntyre from CNN say, no, there's no airplane wreckage here. No airplane hit, but then they took that off right away. And then Shanksville. Shanksville was a divot that now people have gone back and found Google Earth in like 96. That divot was in the ground then. So there was no airplane parts as well there. And, you know, some of the engine parts are made out of titanium. They don't disappear. Mm-hmm. And nothing can be sucked up into a hole in the earth like that. They just disappeared into this ditch. Well, then dig into it, because if it's in there, it should be in there, right? Well, you got landing gear is huge on those planes. 757 is a very large aircraft, and it just doesn't disappear. So if you just dig, well, people can easily Google image search what a crash looks like and see that. So then we have the North Tower, the first one that hit. The Naudette brothers have a video of that. It goes so fast you can't focus on what it was. So we don't know what that was. It was reported by the police in New York that it was a missile shot from the Woolworth building. Now, there's tapes online. You can find the police recordings of that. And then we have more police and fireboat people that reported the plane that hit the South Tower was some type of military plane.
Yeah.
And many of the eyewitnesses said that, too. There were no windows in it, blah, blah, blah. So, cutting to the chase, we know that something happened at four sites, but we know that chances are those four airplanes weren't even involved. And so we got this flight termination system, which, and you'll remember the missing, lost, and misplaced $2.3 trillion.
Yes.
From the Pentagon. The guy who was the comptroller at the Pentagon also owned a company that made the flight termination system.
Yes, very interesting connection. Now, where do you think those planes went? You speculate on that in the book.
It's not a speculation anymore. I don't usually give that out because I want the reader to read the book, but it isn't a speculation anymore. It's been actually reconfirmed since the book has come out, and I've done several large audience interviews, and I've got people that were there and have witnessed it. So it's, to me, not speculation at all. It's definitely reconfirmed.
Okay, that's good to know. So we won't give that away then to the listener who may read your book.
No, well, how I found that was I actually teach the reader how to go in and do that, and that's exactly what my main protagonist does, is what I did to discover that. Once I found out, because I actually flew out of Boston, once I found out that the Boston planes, where they were taken, I had to map a flight time between Newark and Washington, D.C., and it worked perfectly with when the phone calls were made. Hmm. And that's how you can rule out planes going to Cleveland. Cleveland from Boston's an hour and 45-minute flight. They couldn't have been there in 18 minutes to make those phone calls. So that's how I discovered what I discovered. Now, I have people coming forward that are telling me what was going on at that location. So
wow, that's really amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing, and it's kind of, in a sense, frightening.
Now, will you be creating some kind of a website like Flight Attendants for 9/11 Truth where all the documentation you've gathered can be posted?
No, I don't have any intention to do anything like that. And right now, one, I've got a terabyte of data that I'm working with a bunch of researchers on, and I'm doing lots of interviews and signing 100 autographed books a day. And, you know, just trying to get that out there. The book has been holding number one position at Amazon in historical fiction, and it's a book, a fiction book full of truth.
Now, that's fabulous.
It caught the attention of people that are just some of the best minds in the country and top researchers that just have come forward, and somebody had to finally figure this out. We can't debunk this. I said, well, I tried, because when I discovered what I discovered, is which is where the planes were taken, how they were taken, and how it was covered up, and these all this information is in my book, and then I just invite the reader to contact me, and if they want to see some documents, like I said, most of this stuff, documentation I've got is from the FBI. A lot of the stuff that we don't know is covered up by the FBI and was never made public in the media.
Yeah, and I think I didn't get this from your book, but I think from listening to you on another interview that you did, and you mentioned something about Muhammad Atta and his membership in American Airlines. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Muhammad Atta, and I've been contacted by American Airlines flight attendants and pursers and pilots. Muhammad Atta was well known as an executive platinum million-mile passenger for 2 to 3 years prior to 9/11. But according to the official Wikipedia on him, his personal history that's on the Internet, and everything you read about him, the official storyline is he wasn't even in this country solidly for 6 months before 9/11. But he flew Flight 11 all the time. and that's Los Angeles to Boston, Flight 11, or Boston to Los Angeles, Flight 12 returned. So all of the flight attendants with American knew who he was, and so they were shocked. They were just shocked to hear that he's a million, I mean, if you're a million-mile passenger, most of us know who you are, especially because flight attendants have a tendency to fly the same route a lot. And so we kind of get into, you know, flying 11, 12 flight numbers like on Friday and Saturday. That just becomes our schedule. We work our kids around it, our husband's schedules and everything. So that's very, very common that flight attendants will fly the same flights on the same days. So, yeah, American Airlines, I guess, was really shocked. But that's another detail that has come to me from getting the book out, that the airline, I don't know if they ever made it public, but the media sure didn't.
So it sounds like the airline personnel have a lot of valuable information that could really maybe blow the lid on 9/11 if they all got together and would speak out about it. So I'm really thankful that you're doing that and that they're coming to you. That's really wonderful. Maybe you can tell the listeners where they can get a copy of your book, what your website is.
Sure, yeah. You can get an autographed copy off my website, and that is just www.methodicalillusion.com. And you can also order this book at any bookstore. So if you have a Hastings or a Barnes & Noble or some kind of bookstore, it's available through Ingram. It's not on the shelf, but they can order it. It'll come in about a week. You can order it on Barnes & Noble online or Amazon. Amazon, since the book became number one 3 weeks ago, instantly put a bestseller banner on and then claimed that the book is temporarily out of stock. That's not true. So people that are ordering it, I get this from people from my website and from Facebook, people that are ordering it off Amazon are getting it in about a week. So you can also order it in a Kindle format, which you can get a free app if you don't have a Kindle. You can read it on your iPad. There's a whole bunch of apps. You can just read it on your computer, and they give you the app for free.
Now, just a couple last questions for you. How long did it take you to write the book, and what do you see yourself doing next?
Well, it didn't take long to write it. Once I gathered all the 9/11 information, I had already started this novel where I was going to grab the Middle Eastern guy's name. So I just picked that up and decided I'll just deliver all of the 9/11 information through this novel. So I'm going to guess, I didn't keep track of it, so, you know, maybe it took a couple months or so to write it. And what happened is I, you know, originally wrote it as a, I could see it happening as like a big movie screen on top of my head out there in front. So when you first write, and I'd never written before, so you're just kind of typing away everything that you see. And then when you go through and you start editing it, you can remember, oh, yeah, I'm going to put this detail in. And so there's kind of a process. And I had written it almost 2 years ago, and it just kind of sat because I didn't know what to do with it. I just like, do I want to be killed over this?
Yeah. Have you had any threats or anything?
I have not, no. And one of the reasons I chose to write it as a novel was hopefully to get some plausible deniability that, you know, you're attacking me over a novel, come on. But I know what happened to Tom Clancy, so I just put it together. And then this year, in September, I had a long conversation with a New York firefighter who spent a month on the pile. And he told me about, I asked him, he didn't offer this unless I asked him, but he told me that there wasn't any human bodies left in most of the firemen that the thing found. They only found their air packs, their breathing apparatus, and that they basically just disintegrated. And
yeah.
That doesn't happen. I mean,
Not with the building collapse, no.
Yeah, not and so I was like, I got off the phone from that, and I was so touched by what he told me that I just told my husband, you know what, we're going to edit this book and get it on the market. And so I literally just went through and went through and through. It's actually being professionally edited now by someone, and a second edition is in the works. The second edition is going to have a new foreword by Neela Sagadevan, who is an aeronautical engineer. And he's a retired airline pilot and a radio host as well. And then Barbara Honegger and Dr. Kevin Barrett are writing just a comment for the back of the book. So it's just been incredibly received. I'm just in shock by it.
Yeah, it's given a really nice boost to the 9/11 truth movement. So it's great that you've done that. And it's very exciting that it has new information to share. And Rebecca, we're almost out of time. Is there anything we haven't discussed that you'd like to share with the listeners before we pause?
Well, you were asking me what's next. I am working on a sequel. I feel like I'm living the sequel. I do have a lot of researchers that have come forward and just lots of information, and the airline people and some military people that are coming forward with information. my hope is that as people hear interviews, that they contact me through my website. There's an email button and there's a contact. It all goes right directly to my personal email, as well as so does the book orders. If you want an autographed book, it's $20 total with shipping and everything from there. And I just want people to feel comfortable to come and give me their information. And the more we have, the more chances are we have of exposing who the real perpetrators were, because the sad part about this is that we have killed millions of people that had nothing to do with this.
Right. It continues to this day, right. Well, thank you very much, Rebecca, for writing the book and for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, you're so welcome, Cheryl.
And again, you've just been listening to an interview with Rebecca Roth, author of the recently released book on 9/11 called Methodical Illusion. To learn more, her website is methodicalillusion.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.